the users used to drop by the office. That's so crazy to me.
I know. And the woman dressed up as Pinterest for Halloween.
Yeah. And here's ornaments for all of you. How many people work at your company? Great, I'll make you 25 ornaments.
I know, so great.
Welcome to Season 4, Episode 5 of Acquired, the podcast about technology acquisitions and IPOs. I'm Ben Gilbert.
I'm David Rosenthal.
And we are your hosts. Today we are talking about a company that is not a social media company. Or is it? Pinterest. For context, this is a company that has more users than Snap, though a little bit less than Twitter, is used by 80% of moms in America, and is actually a pivot of an early failed mobile shopping app. But we will get into that.
Indeed, we will. As always, here on Acquired.
This is episode 2 of the A+ IPO saga. We are proud to be coming at you. 2 days here after trading? It started trading on Thursday, and then yesterday the stock market had the day off.
Yep.
So we've got 1 day of data here, and we'll be, of course, talking about the entire story of Pinterest, but had a nice little pop in the market as well that we'll touch on.
Yeah, we've got, so far, we have the P&L of the A+.
Indeed. All right, so listeners, today we are talking about a company's exit, and really that's what we do on every episode of this show, but there are lots of company creation topics that David and I can't help but discuss, and as many of you know, we have a second show for that, the Limited Partner Show. So last week on the LP show, we spent an hour diving into a required topic for every entrepreneur, the term sheet. We went through line by line, analyzing each term of a standard Series Seed term sheet, and of course, offering our editorial on each one. If you are interested in hearing us, two non-lawyers, try to put it in as plain of English as we possibly can, you should definitely consider becoming an LP. And we have a big announcement today. It's big news on that front. We have heard from a lot of you that you wanted to listen to the LP show, but you weren't sure how it worked. So we decided to change the sign up and offer every new person who joins a 7-day free trial, just so there's no need to take the plunge blind. You can listen right here in the podcast player of your choice and sign up in 2 taps. Yes, only 2 taps, by tapping the link in the show notes or going to glow.fm/acquired. Yes, note the new and official name of the company, Glow. And as the person who works on the product behind the LP show, I am selfishly very excited to see how well the new trials feature works. So please do not be shy to check it out.
Yeah. Big congrats to Ben and team for getting all that out.
Thank you, sir. All right. Well, David, this is the perfect time to talk about one of our favorite companies, StatSig.
Yes. When we had Vijay on ACQ2 earlier this year, they were already a pretty impressive kind of Series B stage startup with a killer team and early product market fit. But what's happened since and the scale that they're operating at now is pretty wild.
This is where we get lucky in being very choosy with our sponsors. Sometimes these things happen to them while we're mid-flight.
Yes. So I asked them for some fun stats. In the past month, StatSig shipped actual live product experiments to over 1.2 billion end users. Now, that stat is not deduplicated across apps, so there's some overlap. But I mean, even if you cut that in half to approximate actual flesh and blood human people out there, that's almost 10% of the world's population.
Crazy.
Okay, so that's one. Two, StatSig now processes about 130 billion events per day. So the infrastructure that StatSig now has to support these data volumes is pretty wild. And it's not like they just execute these events. They then take all the data from them, run huge statistical jobs across the whole corpus to compute the experiment results that their customers are running. It is just wild.
It's funny, I hadn't thought to make this comparison until right now. So you said 1.7 million events a second. If you look at the Visa numbers, I just pulled up my Visa notes. Visa does 8,600 transactions per second. So that's what, 200 times as much throughput at StatSig than at Visa?
On the customer side, StatSig added arguably almost all of the most important AI companies in the world this year, including Microsoft, Atlassian, Anthropic, along, of course, with regular old companies like Notion and UiPath and Lattice and Brex and friends of the show Rec Room. The team also kept shipping super fast. At the start of the year, they had just one core product. Today, they're a full-fledged product understanding platform. They have dedicated feature flagging, warehouse native experimentation, and product analytics.
Yep. So if your team wants the best platform in the world for making data-driven product decisions, you should reach out. Statsig.com/acquired. And as always, there is special white glove onboarding for all acquired listeners. Our huge thanks to Statsig. All right, David. That is all I have before the illustrious history and facts.
Are we ready to dive in here?
We are.
Well, let's do it. So today, we start our story in the 1980s, mid-1980s, early 1990s. Special time for me. Probably it was a little bit later for you, but for you, Ben, too. We're all of us millennials growing up. And there was another Ben Silberman, who was growing up in the middle of the country in Des Moines, Iowa, around this time. And I remember growing up, my parents always used to joke whenever they talk about like shipping me off to somewhere random when I was like being bad growing up, they'd say, you know, I'm going to send you to Des Moines. Ooh. Apparently Des Moines is a really great place. So, man. Anyway, Ben Silberman talks about how it is a really great place and it's going to play a big part in the story here.
Have you been to Des Moines?
I have not. No,
that's
but
awesome.
It looks
it's
beautiful.
It's actually really awesome. Yeah.
Yeah. Is it part of the Quad Cities or is it?
That is deeper than my knowledge on the area.
On Midwest geography. Okay. Anyway, regardless whether it is or isn't, Ben Silberman is growing up there around this time, and he's a middle child. He has two sisters, an older sister and a younger sister. He comes from a family of doctors, of MDs. Both of his parents are doctors. They are ophthalmologists in Des Moines. His grandparents were doctors, and both of his sisters would go on to become doctors later in life. So Ben thinks, you know, this is basically his destiny. He can't escape this. But he's a quiet kid. And he actually says at a talk later that he wants to be known in life for the things that he makes, not the things that he says. Quite in contrast to your typical Silicon Valley unicorn founder. This is going to be a theme here.
Yeah, I was going to say, listeners, like Dave and I were chatting before the show. It actually takes quite a bit of research to find a lot of the best stories about Pinterest because they're a very sort of do the work and let the work speak for itself company rather than beating a drum that many of their other companies do to attract talent and you know, share the spotlight and be in the news a lot. Pinterest just never really had that in their personality.
No, totally. I mean, this is probably the most work we had to do researching the history of the company and founders, you know, in a long time. Not because there aren't great stories here. There are. We're going to tell them. But, you know, unlike Airbnb or Lyft or Uber, you know, the founders, Ben and Evan and Paul, just don't talk about them. But we found them nonetheless. So Ben's growing up and he's a quiet kid, likes to, you know, let his work do the speaking. And he's very good at work. He's a very good student, as you would imagine, coming from the family that he comes from. He also supposedly collected stuff. Hard to verify if this is true or this was added as part of the lore later. Feeling like I know Ben after watching basically every talk he's given over the last 10 years in the last couple of weeks. I actually believe him. Famously, he supposedly had a bug collection, you know, like where you'd have a
board
and then you would pin bugs onto it. I think there was a Calvin and Hobbes series about this. Yeah. So great. So Midwest. Love it. So Ben is a great student, Ben Silberman. Ben Gilbert was probably also a great student in high school. Silberman, though, goes to Yale and he does pre-med as he is destined to do. He majors in political science and does pre-med on the side. And, you know, I remember I had tons of friends. I was in college right around this time, too. Also do the same, you know, be pre-med, but major in something else. And one day, though, Ben wakes up. It's his junior year. And he talks about he just kind of has this feeling that, you know, he's been doing pre-med and, you know, he's doing well, of course. But he's just not sure that medicine is right for him.
Not his destiny.
It's not his destiny that he might have thought it was. He's interested in other stuff. And in particular, and I can so relate to this because I was in basically the same moment in my life and history when I went to college. When he went to college was the first time he had his own laptop and his own, you know, dedicated broadband high-speed connection to the internet. And he basically fell in love with it. He was like, this is so cool. This is the industrial revolution of our time. And, you know, I'm a young person, I see this, and he gets access to it in school for the first time. And he just starts tinkering. He builds a bunch of, you know, what he calls toys with friends while he's in Yale. He builds a website where you can try on eyeglasses. Remember, his parents are ophthalmologists, so he's in college. He builds this website where that you can virtually try on eyeglasses. I don't even know how he did this at the time with whatever web technologies were.
Yeah, because in like 2014 or whatever, when Warby Parker rolled it out, it was like, whoa, it's incredible.
Yeah, he basically invents Warby Parker, just a little bit ahead of his time. So he's tinkering around with all this stuff, and he decides, you know, I think I'm not going to go to med school, at least not right away. And so he goes and he talks to his other friends who were at Yale and also liberal arts majors, but weren't pre-med, and asks them, hey, what are you guys doing? And they're like, we're going to all these consulting interviews and investment banking interviews because that's what you did. And Ben says, oh, okay, cool. I should do that too. He does the whole consulting interview circuit. He ends up getting an offer and joining a consulting firm, which I think has been acquired now. I remember these guys, Corporate Executive Board. They were based in Washington, D.C. And so he joins them. He moves down to D.C. after school. And two big things happen there, really important things that are important for the future of Pinterest. One, he gets assigned randomly, I believe, to the IT consulting practice within CEB. He's like, this is great. I love the internet anyway. I'm going to work on IT, you know, consulting related projects. And he gets really into it and he starts reading TechCrunch, which had just come out around then. Of course, I remember this too. And he's reading about all these startups out in California, like Dig and, you know, Yelp was just getting started. This was the Web 2.0, dawn of the Web 2.0 era. And he's like, man, I really kind of want to be a part of this. The other really important thing that happens during his couple years as an analyst at CEB, he meets his girlfriend, who would become his wife, Divya. And Divya worked also at CEB in the HR consulting group. So Ben's in the IT consulting group, Divya's in the HR consulting group. And as the story goes, one night they're watching a movie in DC and they watch The Pirates of Silicon Valley, which is,
yeah.
I still have not seen. I need to watch incredible. This movie. It's so, I've heard it's so great. It's kind of it's like a crime that I haven't watched this movie.
I'm not sure if it's more cringeworthy or more like legitimately awesome, but it has so much of both that, I can't believe it was only ever a TV movie.
I know. And it's about, Steve Jobs and Bill Gates and the rivalry between them and Microsoft and Apple.
Highly dramatized in like whatever 90s or early 2000s sort of like camera angles and lighting. And it's just so, so utterly dramatic.
And there's this ridiculous line in there. Ben talks about, he gives a talk that I'll reference later where he literally has a slide and he has this line, this quote on the slide. There's this super cheesy line in there that I think Bill Gates' character says, there might be something going on in California. And according to Ben, this inspires him and Divya. And they're like, you know, what are we doing in D.C.? We got to move out to Silicon Valley and be where the action is. So they do. A little while later, this is 2006, I believe. They move out to Silicon Valley, out to Palo Alto. Ben ends up getting a job at Google in ad operations. Divya gets a job. She wants to work at a startup, so she gets a job at a cool startup right off Cal Ave in Palo Alto. You may have heard of it. It's called Facebook. She joins them in 2006. She is the first HR. Remember, she was doing HR consulting at CEB. She becomes the first HR person at Facebook.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Which is pretty
story.
Awesome. And yeah. Is also going to have a huge impact on Pinterest. Ben works at Google for a little under 2 years, I believe. He really wants to do a startup. You know, he's like obsessed with TechCrunch. He's tinkering with all sorts of stuff on the side. And every night he's talking to Divya. He's like, oh, what about this? Like, I want to work on this. What should I do? And again, supposedly they're having dinner one night and Divya is just sick of this. She's working at a startup and she's like, Ben, you know, you might want to just either do this or just stop talking to me about it. And I could so imagine this. Jenny and I have had many versions of this conversation. And Ben's like, you know what? You're right. So it's fall of 2008 at this point, and he decides he's going to leave Google. He's going to launch his own startup. He's going to live the dream. He has an idea, and he's got a couple friends that he's going to work on this company idea with. And he wants to build a website that holds that stores your medical history, your family's medical history. So not like an EMR, but a place where you can store, you know, what is your grandparents' family medical history, your parents' medical history, you know, your siblings. Actually seems, you know, really relevant. So it's fall 2008. He goes off to do this. He quits Google. He walks out. And then like a week later, Lehman Brothers collapses. It's amazing. We'll get back later in the show to how impactful that event was on so many things in the world.
I think there's probably four or five episodes now where that's been a turning point in the history of each of these companies.
Yeah, totally. And the most direct impact that has on young Ben Silverman and the company that would become Pinterest is nobody else who he was talking about doing with this ends up leaving and joining full time. I think some people may have been at Google. Some people might have been friends. He's talked about that were in PhD programs. Everybody's like, nope, the world's falling apart.
Yeah, everybody go to cash, keep your job, don't do anything risky.
Yep. Yeah. And so Ben's out there. He's all alone. He's quit. He's gone. So he goes out and he tries to raise money. He has this idea, this website he wants to build, but angel investors or early stage VCs at that point are investing in like anything, let alone some random, you know, ad ops guy from Google who's a solo non-technical founder.
Come on, the bottom's the best time to buy. This is when you should be investing.
Oh man, I can't wait to do the Airbnb episode hopefully later this year where we tell their version of this story, which is also very similar. So he can't raise any money. He has no co-founders, no ability to build a product. He does a bunch of things just to kind of pay the bills and get by. Fortunately, Divya is, you know, working at Facebook and doing pretty well. So she keeps the fledgling family afloat.
And they're still well pre-IPO at this point. I mean, they hadn't found mobile yet. They hadn't,
this is 2008.
Facebook's doing well, but it's doing well on venture dollars, not on its real business model.
Yeah, totally. So Ben ends up moonlighting. He helps design a product and a company called Mighty Quiz, which was a Y Combinator company. I forget, were they in the first batch?
It wasn't the first, but it was not the first, but a very early batch.
Yeah. Very early batch. They might have been in the same one as Dropbox.
I think Dropbox was Dropbox in the Reddit batch, because Reddit I think was the first. Dropbox, yeah, may have remember. Been. Yeah, it was first 2 or 3 years.
It was definitely early on. They powered trivia games for other websites out there. Doesn't work, of course, but that's how he gets exposed to Y Combinator. I was always wondering. Ben goes back and he does talks at YC Startup School, and I was trying, like, Pinterest, did they do YC? Didn't do what? But that's how Ben became involved with YC. He's doing this and he's looking for something to do. He comes upon, he realizes, you know, he loves this iPhone, and the iPhone SDK had come out earlier that year in 2008, and it just started to open up to third-party applications. Because remember, the first year and a half of the iPhone, it was only apps from Apple. There were no third-party apps on it.
It was iPhone OS 2 that had the App Store and the SDK.
Yeah, and famously, Steve Jobs was against the idea initially, yep, of having third-party apps on the iPhone.
But man, he Bezos-style disagreed and committed, and they shipped it anyway.
Yeah, how different history would have been if that had not been the case. So Ben sees this and he's like, okay, this might be the wave that I missed the sort of Web 2.0 wave, but this might be the wave that I can ride to build a big company here. And so he hooks up with another friend from undergrad, from Yale, named Paul Sciarra, who, very random that Paul would end up becoming his co-founder, because Paul lives in New York, is also not technical, but Paul had a very important aspect to his background and skill set.
He knew investors.
He had been an associate at a venture capital firm, uh-huh, called Radius Ventures, uh-huh, in New York, and he knew investors. And what was one thing that they needed? Money.
Money.
Money. And Paul, of course, also saw the opportunity that the opening of the App Store would unlock. Says, okay, great. We're going to build a company. We're going to build iPhone apps. They decide to call the company Cold Brew Labs, because it sounded cool.
Like, listeners, we try and pour over, like, what's the real origin story? What's, you know, what is the company espousing? Like, ayo, this is all we could find. Like, it's that it sounded cool and they just rolled with it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was the actual story.
Yeah.
Paul, though, because, you know, they need to raise money and Paul has all these investor relationships, they decide it's natural he should be the CEO of the company. So he's in New York and Ben is out in Palo Alto and he's the CEO and they hit the fundraiser. They decide, well, first they decide, what are they going to do to build iPhone apps? And Ben has this idea. I actually don't know whether it was Ben or Paul. They come up with this idea for a product that they call Tote. T-O-T-E.
And we should pause here before diving into what Tote is. This was like aha moment number one for me doing the research that Ben Silbermann was not the initial CEO of Pinterest.
Yeah.
I think that, David, you even texted me like, whoa, did you realize this? This is just one of those things that ends up buried in the lore that's the sort of super fun when we're diving in and trying to figure out what's going on. Ben, while the sort of visionary and, you know, the person that we chose to start the story with in his upbringing, was not the CEO of the company.
And despite having left his job at Google earlier and been searching around for a company to start, they decide that they're going to build this app called Tote and release it on the App Store. How they got the idea for this, I don't know. The idea is that you get all these paper catalogs, you know, direct mail catalogs sent to you in the mail for all sorts of things, you know, fashion, home decor, you know, Pottery Barn, what have you. Wouldn't it be interesting if instead of getting those in the mail, you could get them on your new smartphone device?
David, that is just what I want. It's just what I want.
Oh, man, I can't wait to read more catalogs. And so they decide they're going to do this. But there's no like API for, you know, getting products and catalogs from companies. So they start getting catalogs and just like by hand ingesting the product data into the app, like typing in like, oh, here's this, you know, dress at Forever 21. It's priced at this, like take a picture of it. Here's the picture.
Wild.
Talk about doing things that don't scale.
And this is 2008. Like there was zero evidence that anyone wanted to do anything that resembled shopping on mobile yet.
Yep. End of 2008, beginning of 2009. They think, okay, we've got this great idea. We're working on this product now. We're gonna go out and we're gonna raise money with, you know, our new great VC connections. Everybody turns them down. They meet with like everybody in Silicon Valley. People more or less laugh them out of the room. Rightly so at that point in time. So they get so desperate. This is later on in the spring.
And actually, David, I'll push you on rightly so, because if they had invested, they would have been the first investor in Pinterest. So it is interesting. Right. It's like rightly so on the idea. But
yes. Well, and that's the art of early stage investing, which we'll get into more as we go here. So they're so desperate for money to pay the bills that they start applying to business plan competitions at colleges that they didn't even go to. They're just doing anything to try and get some money. And presumably also some money to, you know, pay some developers to actually build this because they can't build this. According to Ben, they go to several. They go to one, I believe this was NYU. I couldn't verify, but I believe this was NYU's business plan competition. They end up getting second place in the competition. So they don't get any prize money. But what they get for coming in second is a meeting with a VC. And that VC happens to be a VC in New York, a brand new firm that has just gotten started at this point in time, which, side note, must have been incredibly difficult to start and raise a first-time fund in the middle of 2008, 2009.
Oh God, yeah.
Man, it was hard enough doing it at Wave in 2017, 2018. But
and David, to double down on that, imagine how hard that is. You're an early firm. You're making one of your first few investments, and it's Pinterest.
Yeah, exactly. Well, so these guys, First Mark Capital, which is now a great, much larger VC firm based in New York, they'd just gotten started. They were the second place door prize in this competition. And so they meet with Paul and Ben and this app called Tote. And for whatever reason, they take a shine to them and they say, okay, great. We'll throw you guys a couple hundred K. Like, let's see what you do with this. So First Mark becomes the first institutional investor in Cold Brew Labs. You can read the Form D that gets filed. Paul signs it as the CEO of the company. They invest a couple hundred K.
And we do this part later, but just to sprinkle some numbers on this, Pinterest, their IPO price was at $19 a share. And when they opened trading, it was at almost 24 bucks a share. These shares were bought for 1 cent per share.
Yeah. So they do pretty well. And I believe First Mark still owns about 9 9-ish% of Pinterest. Man, the art of early stage venture capital and betting on teams. Great investment there. With these resources, they hire some developers. They ship the app, but nobody really uses it because, you know, again, who wants to really be shopping catalogs on your, at that point in time, 3.5-inch iPhone screen?
There's a few things there. It's like no one was conditioned to that behavior yet. Phones weren't rich enough in their functionality to sort of give you the confidence that doing things like shopping or booking travel or anything on them was like actually going to work. And you had sort of the richness of the software required to do those things.
At this point in time, you had 3G. I think you were past the edge days of the iPhone, but... Yep. You know, loading high quality images still took a while.
Totally. You know, this was the era where trying to update your app took like 2 weeks. So, you know, any time that anything was wrong, it's not like that we have sort of the, number one, the update speed that we have today, but number two, the ability to change a lot of stuff on the server. I think the apps weren't that sophisticated yet and had just a lot of really heavy stuff on the client side. And so I think that not only was there only a small segment of people willing to do this crazy thing called shop on their phone, but then even more so, it was really hard to actually iterate on this thing.
Yep. Hard on all fronts. So one day later on, a couple months later in 2009, Ben is visiting New York. I assume he's visiting because Paul is still there. And a mutual friend says to Ben, "Hey, there's this guy here I know that I'm also friends with. You guys seem really similar. Like, you should just like grab a drink. I think you would really like each other and meet while you're in town." The friend that the mutual friend was talking about is a architecture grad student named Evan Sharp. And
boy, Pinterest really keeps finding the exact right people for these roles with just the right backgrounds.
Exact right people at the right time. Bam. As with all of these stories, it's so funny when you dig into them, you know, the number of just random events that lead to these incredible stories and companies being created. You know, the same thing with the Lyft co-founders meeting on Facebook.
So Evan was, he had an architecture background, but he actually had some super applicable skills from tech companies, right? Was he at Facebook?
Not yet.
Oh,
so he's just okay. An architecture grad student in New York. Ben and Evan grab a drink. They're chatting, and Evan's, you know, saying like he has, talking about how he loves, you know, he's so into architecture and design, and he's curated. He has thousands of architectural photos and drawings and designs that he's saved online, but it's so hard to keep them organized, and he's got this whole system, and they're riffing, and Ben is like, "Oh yeah, like I love collecting things too."
And bug collection. You know,
yeah, I had a bug collection. I've had this idea of I love tinkering with stuff, and like one of the things I'd always wanted to build is a product that would let you collect things online and save them and organize them. And they start riffing, you know, and eventually Ben's like, "Man, like we're really in sync. You should come join me and Paul at Cold Brew and like work on what we're working on Tote. And like, maybe we can move the product in this direction." Evan, though, you know, he's still in grad school and he's super passionate about architecture and design. And he does want to work in tech. He wants to be a product designer, but he's not super interested in a really early stage startup that doesn't have a lot of great prospects. So in fact, what he's interested in, and I don't know if he already had this lined up, but when he graduates from architecture school, he goes and he works at Facebook as a product designer. But he's like, you know, I like you guys. I don't think I want to do this full time and drop out of school, but I'll work with you on the side. And I wonder if he didn't have the job at Facebook yet, I imagine this helps him in his interview process that he's working on the side with a startup that would become Pinterest. So they all start working together. And there was, you know, along the same vein, Tote did have this feature that they already had in there that let people save items for later that they were browsing in the catalog. And the very few people who were using Tote, they all seem to be using that. And as when they talk to users, they seem to kind of like it. You know, and it makes sense. I was talking with my wife, Jenny, about, you know, what she uses Pinterest for these days and likes it. And you know, the analogy that she said to me is, you know, Pinterest is like the online version of when you're reading a magazine and you see something interesting and you tear the page out or you fold the page down to save it for later. And that's literally what was happening in Tote. So they decide to focus on that and build out this feature a little more. And they combine it with, you know, sort of this broader idea like, okay, let's get beyond just shopping and catalogs, but kind of organizing everything that you come across on the internet. So Evan designs it in his free time, and he comes up with probably the most important unlock that really makes this happen from a product standpoint. He comes up with the grid layout. now it doesn't seem all that remarkable. You go to Pinterest and everything is laid out in a grid of images. But at the time, this was really novel. The idea of laying out all these images in a grid in front of you. But there were a couple things. One, it was liquid and adaptable. So depending on the sizes of the images, the grid would readapt and make the images all look good instead of resized to fit in like very specific size squares. The other thing that they did, and I don't know if this was intentional or not, but the grid was oriented around vertical photos, not horizontal photos.
Interesting, to allow more of them to be across the screen at once.
Yeah, I imagine that's why they did it. And at the time, the first version of this, of Pinterest, was only on the web, not on mobile. And it, even despite Tote being, coming out of Cold Brew Labs to build mobile apps, they said this product needs to live on the web. Wouldn't even come to mobile until 2011. But then when it did, this vertical image prioritization was perfect for mobile.
I remember back in this time, when Pinterest shocked the world with what is canonically the Pinterest layout, there were so many little clones. Like everybody tried to add a Pinterest-style view to their product. Or you'd see on Hacker News, oh, Pinterest for X. And Pinterest meant that fluid layout. That was a sort of the board that was laid out in the adaptable, fluid way to lay out images. There's sort of an interesting meta topic here that products get shaped using the technology available and what is easy using that technology. And so it makes sense that on the web for the longest time, what we saw were tables and what we saw were, sort of articles that had inline images. And it's not an obvious and easy thing to do in early HTML and CSS to lay something out in this way, and particularly to do infinite scroll and a lot of the things that we come to expect knowing that these layouts exist now. And it's fascinating to think whenever you're designing a protocol or a platform or a core technology that you're really shaping the, first 5 years or whatever, the first several set of use cases of what people actually do with it.
Evan, he's an architecture grad student in New York who designs this and would go on to be one of the most influential, internet and mobile UI paradigms, of the last 10 years. Super cool. So they have this. They're pretty excited about this new version of the product. It's now November 2009, Thanksgiving. And over Thanksgiving, Ben and Divya are at Thanksgiving. They're watching TV. Ben had been, trying to think about what are we going to call this new product, because Tote doesn't make sense anymore. And of course, talking with Divya about it, they're watching TV. I assume at least most US listeners are going to remember the commercials that were all the rage at the time, the Dos Equis commercials with the most interesting man in the world. And those commercials were so great.
How is this related, David? Where are we going?
It's related because they're watching TV. A Dos Equis commercial with the most interesting man in the world comes on, and Divya is like, that's it. That's the name for the company. Pinterest. Because they were talking about pinboards and the interesting man in the world, and that's when inspiration strikes. And that's where Pinterest is born.
Wow.
Yeah. So I don't know what the moral of the story is there. Like, spend more time watching TV with your loved ones.
That's it. Spend more time with your loved ones feels like a great lesson to take away from any of this.
Yeah. So great. They've got a name for the product. They've got this super innovative grid UI. They're ready to ship. January 2010, they launch. They email all their friends in Palo Alto, everybody that they know from Google, and Divya's friends at Facebook. And Evan, of course, is going to Facebook at this time. And nobody uses it. Everybody's like, what is this for? What am I supposed to do with this?
What's interesting to me, too, about this point in the story is it's not like they had done an exercise and said, okay, who's our core target user? What is our ideal customer profile? We all know today Pinterest is, I believe it's like 2/3 used by women. And they didn't come up with it and say, okay, what product can we build for moms? It was very much, here's a thing that is very agnostic to who's using it and what they're using it for, and let's just see. I'm sure you'll get into this, but like, how did they find that the right use case and who the real target user was?
Yeah, well, so Before that happens, though, they're trying to do everything they can to get their friends to use it, to, you know, do growth hacking, you know, which is all the rage at the time. So what they think is going to be really cool, they go to the Apple store. Ben goes to the Apple store in Palo Alto. I don't know if he does this every day or just for a couple days.
And he just pull it up on all the computers.
Yeah, he goes to all the computers and he changes the home screen to Pinterest on all the computers in Palo Alto. Has precisely zero impact. they apply to TechCrunch Disrupt and they get rejected.
Didn't they like pull some strings to like get in somehow?
I guess Firstmark was a sponsor and they pull some strings and they get them like a booth at TechCrunch Disrupt, but they're not part of, you know, the battlefield. Like things are bad. Everybody's pretty down. But there is a ray of hope. And that is some of the people that they've been trying to get to use it, they were literally anyone they know, were Ben's friends back in Des Moines that he'd grown up with. And these people were like so far from Palo Alto techies, but they seemed to like it. And the other thing they had going for them back in Des Moines was Ben's parents and Ben's mom. You know, they're still ophthalmologists in Des Moines. They have all these patients. And Ben's mom just starts telling all of her patients to use Pinterest.
God, this is like the equivalent of like when the Snapchat story where it was Evan Spiegel's mom was a teacher at school.
His cousin, I think.
That's right. His cousin was
a high school student.
And they were using it to message. Yeah.
Yeah, because iMessage and other apps were banned. Messaging apps were banned. Yeah, so great. But they all had their iPads. This is like the Pinterest equivalent. So they start seeing this and they're like, okay, interesting. I'm not sure if this was related or not, but on a whim, Ben goes to a conference in Salt Lake City that January called the Alt Summit, which is a big women-focused design and blogging conference. I think a friend had suggested that he should go there, but I don't think he had really that much intention of, this could be the promised land of our user base. He goes there, he's talking to everybody about Pinterest, gets a bunch of people signed up, and they start using it. And then on the flight back from Salt Lake City to San Francisco, at the conference, he meets a woman named Victoria Smith, who's a blogger who lives in San Francisco. She has a blog called SF Girl by the Bay. She's actually moved to LA now, which is, of course, breaks the hearts of, you know, all San Francisco people. But at the time, she lived in San Francisco. And so they kind of hit it off, and they're on the flight back, and they decide, like, hey, let's do a collaboration together. So Pinterest is gonna work with SF Girl by the Bay, and we're gonna do this thing called Pin It Forward, where Victoria will create a pin board with all the things that mean, quote unquote, mean home to her, things that inspire her of home, and then they're gonna tag another blogger and ask the next blogger to create a board doing the same thing for them, and then just kind of pass it around through all the bloggers that are in this network and have been at the Alt Summit. And they do it.
Sounds like a growth hack.
It sounds like a growth hack. The bloggers get really into it, and they, of course, all have their, like, you know, small but rabid fan bases of their blogs. Their audiences love it. They start using Pinterest. Lo and behold, things start to turn around and the company starts to work. And so this is a total aside. This is 2010. A couple of years later, 2012, Pinterest is now a hot startup in the Valley. I'm starting business school at GSB at Stanford. And in my electronic business class, we had this great professor, Chaim Mendelsohn. He's like a total legend.
That's an amazing name for a class.
I know. Electronic business. He's like an old school guy. This is a holdover. But he's super smart. And he made us, in like the first week in class, do the same thing on Pinterest. And I never understood why he had us do this random assignment on Pinterest. And now I know. This is why.
What,
this
the
is
pin how it Pinterest forward started. Exercise?
Yeah, the pin it forward exercise. Huh. But he didn't tell us it was the pin it forward exercise. It was just like, all you guys, like, go create a Pinterest board of your hometowns and what, like, home means to you. Huh. And only now, years later, do I see where he got the idea for it.
It's interesting thinking, too, about why it made so much sense for bloggers. Because for them, whether it was part of their own process as a tool, so you can imagine it's kind of difficult to go and collect good links and good images and put them somewhere if you're trying to go look at 100 different websites and then write a blog post about sort of a synthesis of all this stuff. So it's both an interesting tool there, but then also it's probably the best way to showcase at that time a set of things that you want your fans or followers to go and look at, much better than, you know, making a separate WordPress blog post for each thing that you want to show off.
Totally. There's a great talk. Ben goes back to the Alt Summit in 2012, and that's where he has the slide that has the, there might be something going on in California in that talk. But one of the questions from the audience is this woman who says, Pinterest is something like the best thing that has happened to my business and my following, and the worst thing that has happened to my actual blog, because I now do everything on Pinterest. Like, yeah, it's just so much, better vehicle for if you're, you know, a design blog and you're sharing ideas and products that you find with people, to use a service like Pinterest than it is to use a blog. The site starts growing about between 40 to 50% month over month at that point. It's still really small, but it really starts taking off, and it sustains that growth rate for years.
And I mean, that's a magic number for startups. If you're growing 10% week over week, or sort of that 40, 50% range month over month, I mean, that is, you are a high growth startup. And that is how you know you're onto something.
Yeah. All these angel investors that 2 years ago would barely even take a meeting with Ben, they start to notice that something's going on here. So in May of that year, Shauna Fisher, who was the head of M&A at IAC, she had started using Pinterest, probably heard about it from a blog, and she loved it. She emails them and she's like, "Hey guys, I want to invest." Their minds are blown.
Catch me up. What year is this? Is this after they were out of private beta?
They're still in private beta, okay. And they would be in private beta for the next 2 years. So you had invites, and you could invite your friends. So the site is still growing like crazy, and a lot of the invites were distributed via these blogs.
Ah, interesting.
So Shauna invests, and then she introduces Kevin Hartz, who's the CEO of Eventbrite, co-founder and CEO of Eventbrite with his wife, Julia, at that point, and also a prolific angel investor in Airbnb and others. He invests, friend of the show, Scott Belsky, invests. And there's like serious momentum behind this company. This is a fun aside, but also part of the story. July, a couple months later, they do the first real life Pinterest meetup with Victoria, with the SF Girl by the Bay vlog, at a store in Noe Valley called Rare Device, which is now moving to Hayes Valley, but is like right down the street from where Jenny and I live now in Noe Valley. Too funny. That's the first physical Pinterest meetup. And Ben goes, and all these people come out. It's not like a huge amount of people, but they're all like so engaged, and they love the product so much. And they're talking about how all the things that each other is pinning on about their homes and about everything else on Pinterest is inspiring them to go do these projects. And they're supporting each other and working with each other on these projects. And Ben is like, "This is it. We have figured out what Pinterest is, who it's for. And we're going to double down on this."
And at this point, Ben is doing things like giving out his personal phone number, giving out his address, saying like, "Hey, please reach out to me anytime you have any feedback." Or he really started doubling down on building this sort of wildly intimate relationship with the Pinterest users around this time.
Yeah, and meetups start happening all over the country. And so at this time, this is great. Remember, Divya was the first HR person, Ben's wife. Now, I don't think they're married yet, but a girlfriend, soon to be wife, Divya, was the first HR person at Facebook. Ben is so inspired about how fast they have to move here. He gets a poster of Facebook's "Move Fast and Break Things" motto, and he makes that the Pinterest motto. And
no
then
way.
Redesigns it. They redesign it in Pinterest font and you know, red lettering, and they post it all over the office.
So the opposite of Pinterest's like actual mantra as a company
yes.
for years and years after that.
Yep. But in these very early days, This is when he realizes, okay, we got something here and we got to move fast. So they've just raised this angel round. They keep growing. And then the next spring, they end up raising a $10 million, which was Series A, from led by Bessemer, which was a very large Series A for the time.
Which closed in May. I want listeners to pay attention to the timeline here. This round closed in May. Just to continue tracking the share price here, that's at 17 cents a share.
Yeah, 17 cents a share. Wow. And what was interesting about this, so Sarah Tavel, who's a great investor and now a GP at Benchmark, she was an associate at Bessemer at the time. And she had heard about Pinterest, and she had found them, and she had lobbied the firm to do it. And Jeremy Levine, the partner who ended up leading the deal, he was coming out to San Francisco one day to meet with Minted, another company. And she'd convinced him like, "Hey, we got to go down to Palo Alto. We got to meet with these Pinterest guys." And Jeremy had like 10 minutes before his flight. He was like, "Okay, fine, I'll go down." and then ends up canceling his flight, staying, and they do the deal. But it was Sarah who was supposed to have it and lobbied it.
It was supposed to be a longer meeting, and then there was traffic because it was raining or something. And by the time he got down there, there was only 10 minutes for the meeting. Then, of course, it's interesting enough that you just skip your flight.
Yeah.
But yeah, like I think we should put a stake in the ground right here and say, just let's notice a trend of amazing women doing things like naming the company, like pounding the table to make the investment. I think Sarah should get a huge amount of credit for this, spotting it super early.
Exactly. You know, it's Divya who comes up with the name. It's Victoria Smith and the Alt Summit, that which is all women focused bloggers and designers that come, you know, lands the product market fit for the company. It was Shauna at IAC who was the first, you know, elite angel investor to recognize the potential of the company and want to invest. And then it was Sarah who found them and led to, and pounded the table to do the Series A. At the same time, this is super fun. So SV Angel, Ron Conway's firm, they had passed on the company during the angel round. Ben and I, a great friend of ours, Leslie Kincaid, was working at SV Angel at the time here in Silicon Valley. And Kevin Carter, who was also there at SV Angel, he was like, man, I think we might have missed this during the angel round that had happened with Scott and Kevin and Shauna the past summer. And maybe we should like see, you know, we don't really do Series A, but like we might want to really try and take another look here. And so Leslie and Kevin lobbied within the firm that SV Angel that, like, hey, we'd made a mistake. We should try and push our way into this round too.
Kevin specifically was like, Leslie, what do you think? This is a female focused site, or at least that seems to be the user base. So Leslie pulls together a focus group of three women, I think at the firm, and basically went back to him and said, yeah, I know we passed, but there's no way we can miss this.
So SV Angel ends up coming in to this Series A as well. And then this is so great. Both Sarah and Leslie, Sarah leaves Bessemer, Leslie leaves SV Angel, go and join the company as early employees. And we have to give shout out to Leslie too. She's helped us with a bunch of these stories and research here. And she now runs the office and is chief of staff to the CTO at Convoy up in Seattle, which is another great company that will be an acquired episode someday.
Yeah. Thank you, Leslie. Thank you for the stories that are to come in this episode. And listeners, you can find links to some cool posts from Leslie's Instagram over the years from 10 employees onward at Pinterest.
Yeah, it's super fun. Go look at these pictures that Leslie has documenting all this, because this is the first time we've had like actual visual accompaniments to the stories that we tell here.
Yep, across three different offices. And yeah.
Yeah, super fun. So we're now in July of 2011. They hit 1 million users. Remember, it's still not open to the public. You still have to have an invite to join. In August of 2011, they're listed as one of Time Magazine's 50 best websites, which actually meant something back then. Now, probably less relevant. Remember, it was May when the Series A got done. We're still in August. And Andreessen Horowitz, spearheaded by Connie Chan, who was on the deal team at the time there, had gotten wind of all this great stuff that was going on at Pinterest. And they come in, Jeff Jordan and Connie come in and lead the Series B just a few months later in the company. They raised $27 million at a $200 million valuation.
Yeah, for those keeping track at home, share price is now up to 72 cents. And in that time from May to August, the valuation goes from $40 million to $200 million.
This is what happens when you hit that exponential growth curve. So they now have tons of resources. A couple months later, though, in April 2012, a transition happens. And this really was, at this point, a long time coming and probably had de facto already happened, if not officially. Ben Silberman finally becomes the actual CEO of Pinterest in April 2012. Paul leaves the company very amicably, ends up doing a few things, and he is now actually the chairman of an eVTOL company, a vertical takeoff
no
and landing
way.
Flying cars company, yeah, called Joby Aviation.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, super fun.
It's an LP show prediction for the, what was our 2019 predictions?
Yeah, eVTOL becomes a thing. That spring, though, the growth just continues on a tear. So the 2012 presidential campaign is in high gear at this point in time. And Obama's running for his second term, and Mitt Romney's running against him. And both actually first Ann Romney, Mitt Romney's wife, and then Michelle Obama joined Pinterest and on the campaign trail start, you know, building pin boards
of
their life and inspiration. And it is huge for the company. In May, so we're now 1 year from when the Series A had happened, the Bessemer and SV Angel Series A. We're now in May of 2012. Rakuten, the Japanese e-commerce company, comes in, leads a $100 million investment in Pinterest at a $1.5 billion valuation.
Man, think about when you're raising money for a company and you're like, you're selling 20 to 30% of it. The leverage that they had to have at that point to say, sure, we'll accept $100 million, but it's going to be on
for 1/15 of the company.
Yeah, wild.
You know, when Leslie had joined, she had joined in November of 2011. So just a few months before, she was the 10th employee. So there were only like 10 people at the company.
Is this a good time to talk about the really forward-looking investment in general administrative, creating infrastructure? Okay, so listeners, one thing that, if you remember one thing from this episode to take away, it's Pinterest thought so far ahead on a lot of things that most companies say, we'll think about that later. Think finance, think HR, think people ops, think workplace, think culture. It was amazing starting really at the, you know, very early on from the company that Ben wanted to build and also, you know, in bringing Leslie in and employee 10, really starting to invest ahead of their growth rather than, you know, a ship that's burning down and you're trying to patch it while it's on fire.
Well, I feel like this is really where the story of Pinterest and the history of Pinterest diverges from a lot of your typical kind of Silicon Valley hypergrowth company. They'd done the A, then they'd had this crazy growth. They'd done the B a couple months later. And like your average Silicon Valley company at this point would have been like, great, let's pour all this money into growth and like go, go, go. And to Pinterest and Ben's credit, I think in the long term, but this really impacted the trajectory of the company. They said, now is the time to pause and build the foundation to support this hyper growth that we know we're going to go through. So yeah, they brought in Leslie as site operations manager. They got really serious about hiring executives and they start bringing over, again, remember Divya is head of, was the first HR person at Facebook. They start bringing over some great, great, great people from Facebook to come in and build out all the infrastructure around the company. So a guy named Tim Kendall comes over and Tim had been an early Amazon guy and then had joined Facebook also very early, was head of all monetization within Facebook. He joins Pinterest in March 2012, at first running product. He then eventually runs product engineering and all of builds the whole ads business for the company. He becomes president of the company. They bring over Barry Schnitt, who was running marketing and communications at Facebook. He comes and joins Pinterest. Don Fall, who was running operations at Facebook, comes and does the same at Pinterest, and really a whole suite of, and I remember I have lots of friends who also were at Facebook and moved over to Pinterest at this point in time, and they start really building out a lot of the senior management and functions to scale up the company. And all these people end up staying a really long time. So Tim is now CEO of a company called Moment, but he stayed about 6 years and built out all of these things at Pinterest. The other thing that they start really investing in and playing to their strengths is women engineers and women on the engineering team. And this becomes a huge asset. I mean, this is well ahead of all of the things we'll cover in the Uber episode.
Yeah, the philosophy was our team across all functions should reflect our user base or, you know, trend much closer to that than most of the industry.
So they have an early Pinterest engineer named Tracy Chow really becomes an absolute leader in recruiting for the company and diversity and in engineering and in Silicon Valley more broadly. Pinterest has way higher percentage of female engineers than your average Silicon Valley company. And it's a huge asset to them.
It's interesting. I was looking at it right before this. It hovers around 25-26% of their engineering team right now.
A fun story too around all this time and right as Leslie was joining the company. So they had been in Palo Alto and their first office there, which you can go look at all our photos and their great early photos. They end up moving to San Francisco. And this was a huge moment at the time. I remember this, like, because Palo Alto was still headquarters of Silicon Valley and where startups were. And there were very few companies that were in the city. And Pinterest moving up from Palo Alto to SF was the start of really the center of gravity shifting up to San Francisco. And it happened because Tim had just joined, Tim Kendall, and he had a friend who knew about, they were looking for a big office space to support all this hiring they were going to do.
Is this the chicken factory?
Yes. He had a friend who knew about an abandoned chicken factory in Soma in San Francisco, right next to the Caltrain station, like perfect location. And so they jumped on it, and the Pinterest now,
awesome.
The core of what's now the Pinterest campus right around the Caltrain station there started in an abandoned chicken factory.
There you have it.
There you have it. So through all this time though, and all these fun stories, there's no revenue. There's no business model. Like, the product is seeing tons of usage and engagement and growth, but they're not making any money, not a dollar of revenue. And
they're even making noise about the fact that they're not. They're getting pressed for this. They're getting, you know, Ben Silverman's getting asked at conferences, and his party line is, we want to be really thoughtful about this. We want to have something like measured growth or thoughtful growth, and we want to do monetization when we feel it is right for our users, which they towed for years after you would think they would start experimenting with monetization.
Which is true, and also fits their personality, but also they have a very traumatic experience with this right after the Series B, but before Tim Kendall joins to come in and ultimately build out the ad and monetization platform. They were seeing that one of the things that started happening on Pinterest from the early days, and especially coming from the blogging community, is people posted pins, and the pins were based on, they put affiliate links in them. So when you click through the pins to the link, it would be an affiliate link to whatever the retailer was that was selling the product. And then the bloggers or whoever posted the pin, they'd make a cut on that transaction. And so Pinterest definitely saw that this was going on. They thought, well, this is pretty interesting. It was probably designed as an experiment from the get-go, but they worked with a company called Skimlinks in early 2012, and they, without warning, they pulled all of the affiliate links, rewrapped them with Skimlinks-powered Pinterest affiliate links, and Pinterest took over all those affiliate links that were running through the site. It caused a huge uproar, and to Pinterest, Ben and Pinterest's credit, they pulled the plug on it immediately, and they apologized. And actually, later on in 2015, they would kick all affiliate links, period, off the platform and just ban them totally. But it was so powerful and demonstrated the monetization potential and Pinterest's place in the commerce flow that for years afterwards, they were still getting checks from like that week or two that Whoa. They had affiliate links on. They were still getting affiliate checks, and it was like a very powerful way to prove the potential here. But then they bring Tim on, and they don't do anything, Ben, as you alluded to, for the next 2 years around monetization after this.
Like 2014 is when they started.
Yep, it was May 2014. They launched Promoted Pins. And by this point in time, they had built all the product and engineering and ad sales functions and organizations to do this right. They launched Promoted Pins. The first Promoted Pin is from Vineyard Vines, the East Coast fashion retailer. It goes well. They work just like we talked about with Emily White on the Instagram episode. They work with a few select partners to start. And then in December 2014, they open it up to everyone. And it starts working really well. So much so that in March of 2015, there's so much hype around the company. They were about to hit 100 million users. They've just launched this advertising platform, Promoted Pins. It's going well. They raise at an $11 billion valuation going from, they had raised a few times at successively higher valuations from the 1.5 earlier, but this is a massive jump up.
This is a pretty firm commitment to, we're going to be a public company. It's really hard when you raise money at higher than a $10 billion valuation to say, you know, we're on an acquisition track of some sort. Yeah.
Not just a public company, but like, this is the next Facebook. You know, there are all these people that have come over, great people from Facebook. There's all this potential. The ad platform is working super well. User growth is going great. You know, think about this, $11 billion valuation, March of 2015. And we'll get into the IPO just now.
So that's been 4 years.
Yeah, exactly.
4 years since an $11 billion valuation.
So things do continue to go well. However, user growth at this point, right after this, basically flatlines. and they had just hit 100 million users. But as we've been alluding to, they have started having a huge problem. They've saturated most of their core target market in the US. They do eventually start going internationally back in starting in 2016, 2017, and that reignites growth. But they just can't get men to use the product. and it's still a big issue to this day.
Yeah. To flash forward to some numbers from the S1 listeners. So today in the US, so that they're up to what, 250 million users,
yep. Globally,
but in the US here, it's 82 million. If you go and you look 3 years ago in Q1 of 2016, that was 65 million users in the US. So when you look at their very nice user growth, albeit not monetization growth internationally, and compared to the United States, international looks like, oh, great, a high growth company. US looks like, okay, it's been pretty flat for a while.
When they did that big fundraise, the vision, like we were saying, was this is going to be the next Facebook. And I think what happens over the next couple of years is the market realizes this is going to be a great company, but has a very specific target market that is not every person in the world.
A very specific target market and a very specific time and place for use rather than all day, every day like Facebook.
So that said, though, the monetization engine starts really working. By 2016, 2 years after they launched it, they did $300 million in revenue in 2016. 2017, that grows over 50%. They do $472 million in revenue. 2018, that grows hugely again. They do $755 million in revenue, which is a serious amount, especially given the, and speaks to the power of, like they saw with the affiliate link test, the power of where they sit in the commerce flow, that even though they have a relatively smaller user base compared to other big social networks, there's incredible monetization potential here.
Yep. If you think in like a Porter's Five Forces sense, they have a tremendous amount of power in this value chain from when the user sees something they're interested in into where Pinterest can sort of steer their attention and how they can derive monetization from doing that. They go into great detail in the S1, but this isn't just point of purchase. It's awareness, it's reminding people about the product, it's steering them to a purchase, and then it's actually executing the purchase. So it is sort of all across the life cycle of you buying something.
On the back of all this, just last month in March of 2019, two very big things happened from the company, two very big announcements. First, Leslie Kilgore joins the board. Do you remember Leslie Kilgore, Ben?
I do, and I was trying to remember from where, so I went and looked her up on LinkedIn. I thought it was something where I like may have known her personally or something like that, and then I looked up on LinkedIn and I was like, oh, previous Acquired episode.
Yes, it's almost like we know her personally. The Acquired superhero with the riding shotgun alongside Barry McCarthy from our Netflix two-parter, Leslie Kilgore, who is the CMO at Netflix. And
now on the board at Netflix.
Yeah, I think that's right. So she just joined the board of Pinterest, which is awesome. I'd love it when the heroes and not Carl Icahn come back into these stories. And then, of course, second, on March 22nd, Pinterest publicly files its S1 to go public. And then over the next week and a half, as we covered on the Lyft IPO episode, the Lyft IPO happens. We'll talk about that in a minute during narratives. But when Pinterest sets the range for its IPO on April 8th, this is after the dip in trading from Lyft, they set it at $15 to $17 per share, which equates to about a range of $8.5 to $11 billion valuation below the last private round, which they had done another private round in 2017 that valued the company at $12.3 billion. So this is pricing below.
It is. And listeners, like, they've done a Series D, Series E, F, G, a G1 or something like that. And then they stop counting the letters, but there's six rounds that are in this sort of $200 million, $300 million range of amount of money that they're raising. They had that rapid acceleration in valuation and then continued to raise sort of hundreds of millions of dollars over and over again, somewhere around that price point for a while.
As the user growth, especially domestically, was flatlining. So then on this past Wednesday, April 17th, they price the IPO at $19 a share above the range, and that equates to a $12.6 billion market cap, very slightly above the last private valuation. And then on Thursday, they start trading and they pop up 28%, close at $24.40 a share, or a $16 billion market cap. So a nice, you know, nicely above the last private round, but still not a 10x here.
The share price is now above where every shareholder bought. So, you know, we've only had one day of trading, and I think we can discuss this, but we saw sort of what happened with Lyft in the couple of weeks after they started trading. But from what we know so far, it looks like the strategy of pricing modestly and being below the last round and then letting the pop sort of happen in the market has worked.
Yeah, as opposed to Lyft, which we saw increased its range during the roadshow several times, then priced above the roadshow, then popped big time on the first day, and then, of course, has been down since then. So,
if there's one thing we should probably learn for ourselves on Acquired, is it's very likely we'll see a pop on the first day no matter what, and then it's, you know, in the weeks and months that follow that we should really be paying attention.
Yeah. So, you know, I think we and everybody were very excited and still are very excited about Lyft and their IPO, but there was a lot of euphoria that has been tampered over the last several weeks.
We want to thank our longtime friend of the show, Vanta, the leading trust management platform. Vanta, of course, automates your security reviews and compliance efforts. So frameworks like SOC 2, ISO 27001, GDPR, and HIPAA compliance and monitoring, Vanta takes care of these otherwise incredibly time and resource draining efforts for your organization and makes them fast and simple.
Yep. Vanta is the perfect example of the quote that we talk about all the time here on Acquired. Jeff Bezos, his idea that a company should only focus on what actually makes your beer taste better, i.e. spend your time and resources only on what's actually going to move the needle for your product and your customers, and outsource everything else that doesn't. Every company needs compliance and trust with their vendors and customers. It plays a major role in enabling revenue because customers and partners demand it, but yet it adds zero flavor to your actual product.
Vanta takes care of all of it for you. No more spreadsheets, no fragmented tools, no manual reviews to cobble together your security and compliance requirements. It is one single software pane of glass that connects to all of your services via APIs and eliminates countless hours of work for your organization. There are now AI capabilities to make this even more powerful, and they even integrate with over 300 external tools. Plus, they let customers build private integrations with their internal systems.
And perhaps most importantly, your security reviews are now real-time instead of static, so you can monitor and share with your customers and partners to give them added confidence.
So whether you're a startup or a large enterprise and your company is ready to automate compliance and streamline security reviews like Vanta's 7,000 customers around the globe and go back to making your beer taste better, head on over to vanta.com/acquired and just tell them that Ben and David sent you. And thanks to friend of the show, Christina, Vanta's CEO, all Acquired listeners get $1,000 of free credit. vanta.com/acquired. So let's go into narratives here. So listeners, what we decided to do in these IPO episodes is walk through what the bulls are saying and what the bears are saying. And that way, as we get into kind of our discussion, we can kind of have a baseline representation of both sides. On the bull case, I think their growth rate relative to their comps of Twitter and Snap is really encouraging. They're growing much faster than Snap or Twitter. To put some numbers behind that, Pinterest grew its user base 23% last year. Twitter and Snap saw user numbers decline. And so when you think about sort of this tier of ad-based, you know, internet social, I think we can leave social out for Pinterest, but social-ish business models.
Platforms,
yes. That
ad-based platforms.
Yes. Very interesting to compare there and very promising. The other thing is, and this is from a great financial summary on Seeking Alpha that we'll put in the show notes, if the growth rate for both revenue and expenses stays the same in 2019 as it did in 2018, Pinterest will be profitable. They'll earn pre-tax $65 million because of the way that the business is monetizing well and user base continues to grow, especially internationally, more monetization domestically and then growth internationally. There's really going to be a business here. And I think you got to really whip out your discounted cash flow models to try and understand, is it worth $13 billion over some time frame? But contrasting this against other IPOs that we're seeing recently where there may not be profitability in sight, wouldn't shock me if it happened in the next year, 18 months.
Yeah. Well, Pinterest is a classic case of the historic technology company business model of very high fixed costs that and basically zero variable costs that get leveraged over a large user base. And once that user base passes a point where the revenue from per user is covering the fixed costs, everything above that is basically pure margin. Now, that is definitely not the case with marketplaces, and especially real world marketplaces, as we saw with Lyft and we'll talk about soon with Uber. But doesn't mean they're bad businesses, but it's just a very different business structure.
Right. Do you have anything else in bulls before we go into bears?
You know, I think the bull case, we alluded to this earlier, but you know, I think Pinterest actually does a really nice job in the S1 laying this out, and Ben Silverman has always said this about it, that it is, you know, you were joking about is it a social network, you know, in the S1 they say Pinterest is the productivity tool for planning your dreams. Dreaming and productivity may seem like polar opposites, but on Pinterest, inspiration enables action and dreams become reality. Visualizing the future helps bring it to life. In this way, Pinterest is unique. Most consumer internet companies are either tools or media. Pinterest is not a pure media channel, nor is it a utility. It's a media-rich utility that satisfies both an emotional and functional need, et cetera. We call it discovery. And I think that is perhaps one of the strongest bull cases here, is that for product discovery, there is nothing quite like Pinterest in the funnel. You know, for Google, Google serves demand fulfillment better than anything known to man. You know, Facebook also serves discovery to a certain extent, but I think it's not quite in the same way or as effective at it as Pinterest is. Pinterest is where you go to specifically look for something. At Facebook, you're being shown products as you're looking at other things.
The Facebook newsfeed is like the best ad format of all time, but it can be a little disruptive.
Yeah, it's like ads in a newspaper, whereas to bring it full circle, Pinterest is like browsing a catalog where you are intending to get inspiration and then act on that inspiration.
Yep. So the biggest bear case, at least to me, is that they will not be the only ones to own this market for long. We've seen Instagram before try to get into both commerce and a Pinterest-style functionality of discovery. Both of them have not gone well. Their recent effort into commerce is much more serious, and they've launched collections, which is going to look a lot like Pinterest boards. If Instagram can do to Pinterest what it did to Snapchat with stories, they'll be in big trouble. But I think, to flip back to Bull real quick, it's a reasonable argument to make that Pinterest actually fulfills a much different emotional need when you open that app than Instagram does. And Instagram may not be able to offer the same solution to that job to be done of getting inspired and collecting things in its format that Pinterest has been able to do by really solidifying its brand. And this is what you go to Pinterest for.
Yeah, I mean, totally. Too, having gone and watched, you know, all these talks by Ben Silverman over the last few years, to his total credit, you know, he's been, if you were to listen to the narratives leading up to the IPO, he and Pinterest are talking about how Pinterest's goal is not to get you to spend more time online, it's to inspire you to do projects offline and take action in the real world. That sounds like a soundbite he came up with to market Pinterest in reaction to everything that's happened with Facebook and Instagram and the rest of the internet over the last, you know, 24 months. That's not true. He's been saying that since 2012. Pinterest has always been about that. And so, yes, the potential mitigation to that, to Instagram, is like Instagram's cultural DNA and Facebook's business model is about the attention suck. And that is not the culture, neither the cultural DNA nor the business model of Pinterest.
The biggest reason to be a bear here isn't that it's not going to be a good business or they're not going to be able to maintain the size of the business, unless, of course, you think that Instagram's going to come in and eat all their lunch. It's that, frankly, it's just the smallest of these online ad platform companies. And when disruptive markets are created, the biggest opportunities tend to get filled first, and then the smaller ones tend to get filled over time. So, you know, when we saw... let's take marketplace businesses, for example, and the sharing economy. If you look at what people spend in GDP, they spend on their house, they spend on transportation, then they spend on food. And you look at sort of Airbnb, and then you look at Uber and Lyft, and then you look at
DoorDash,
you know, DoorDash and Instacart. And, you know, when you see a new paradigm like online advertising, you know, you see the biggest ones that are taken are intent-based search. And then there's, what we didn't realize was going to be such a big market, but social media advertising. And then there's this new thing that is, discovery-based or inspiration-based or curation-based advertising, which is just smaller. Like, it's just not a bigger thing. I was going to wait to make this point in grading, but since we're already here, I want to make the point that when I first started researching, I was thinking there's basically two distinct online advertising markets. They're social-based and they're search-based. But Pinterest is really somewhere between there with the curation and discovery-based. And I think now I'm thinking about it more as a spectrum. And I think if you think about it as sort of a smiling curve where there's way more value creation if you go pure search or pure social, there's less in the middle because frankly, you're not spending as much time there and you're not doing mission critical things there as much as you are during search. But it's still a super sticky product, a super useful product, and a product that monetizes well. It's just not one of the other two.
Yeah. Well, I think this is building off kind of the end of history and facts here where we alluded to this. I'm not sure that it's not that the value is, I think there's a ton of value in Pinterest and what they offer to advertisers, and this discovery engine works incredibly well and is very unique. The problem though is just the product itself, the consumer product, is a niche product, a very large niche. But we alluded to it in History and Facts. There are 86 million-ish MAUs in the U.S., and a very, very, very high percentage of them are women. And men, despite years of trying on Pinterest's part, just don't use the product in nearly as high a percentage. They've tried to fix it. I just don't know that it's fixable with what the product is. So thus, it's just a smaller market.
Everyone is aware that they need to search for stuff, and a third of those or a quarter of those people are aware that they need to be inspired and curate stuff based on what inspires them.
Yep. Hard to know if it is specifically men or women, or that's just the way the psychological profile of users of Pinterest tend to fall out. But there is a huge segment or segments of the population, at least domestically, that despite years of knowing about Pinterest, trying to use it, just really isn't going to become engaged and use it in the same way as the other segments. So, I think when you really think about it, maybe this is the way to think about it with Pinterest, the market for the core Pinterest product is the same market as lifestyle magazines. And if you think about what is the market for lifestyle magazines, it tends to skew heavily towards women. Design magazines, home magazines, fashion magazines. There certainly are men that read lifestyle magazines, but just at a much smaller degree. And that is the market. That is where there is core fit with the Pinterest product. And I think it's had and probably will continue to have a very hard time expanding outside of that.
All right, so that's our bear case. Let's talk, how did the IPO go? So despite my pure burning hatred for this term, undercorn.
That's a terrible, terrible term.
They effectively had a down round IPO. And let's talk about sort of... Flat round IPO. Well, yes.
I think it was technically flat. Okay. The share price was lower, but because there were new shares issued, the end market cap was higher.
Okay. So this has happened before, and we covered it well on the Square episode, where it was so significant of a down round at the IPO that it actually took, what, a year or more to climb back up to their last private valuation price. And so, you saw people who had stock options at a strike price before the IPO, where then they actually had to wait years and years for that to recover from being underwater. So they actually had a compensation issue across the board at the company. That's not at all the case with Pinterest. Basically, everyone is in the clear now. Now, of course, if you look and see that people bought shares at an $11 billion valuation 4 years ago, and it's at 13 now. You know, that's not a phenomenal return like it is for any of these early investors, but I'm not sure that they could have done anything better. And I think it was probably smart of them to not try to make this an up round for vanity purposes.
They obviously saw what happened with the aftermath of the Lyft IPO, and they swung the pendulum hard the other way in being conservative here.
It's interesting to know that we have another data point here of the public markets valuing companies within range of where the private markets have been. And I think like there was a lot of fear coming into this wave of IPOs that those two things were going to be dramatically, dramatically different. It doesn't feel like they are.
No, feels like they've been at the very least priced appropriately in the private markets, maybe appropriately a couple of years ahead of the curve, but not completely mispriced.
So I do think that's actually a great segue into what would have happened otherwise in talking about, so why did they go public? Could they have not gone public? Could they have done a direct listing? One thing that I found really interesting was that they actually have $600 million of cash in the bank, and they've raised about $1.5 billion over time. Their net operating loss right now after tax in 2017 was $126 million, and last year was $63 million. So, you know, they're trending toward profitability. They actually probably didn't need to raise any money in this IPO.
Yeah, this is really puzzling to me. And we were talking about this before the show. So by those numbers, even if they maintain the same burn rate, which they won't because they're trending to profitability, assuming revenue keeps growing, they have years of runway still in the bank. Why did they just raise all this money and dilute themselves? This seems like a clear-cut case for me for doing a DPO.
Yeah, David, it does feel like they totally could have done a direct offering here. I mean, they've got cash in the bank. They're going to get profitable. I do wonder, are they
have Leslie Kilgore on their board, you know, access to Barry McCarthy here.
and you know, it's that went well enough that we're hearing rumors Slack is going to do a direct listing here in the near future. And so there could be two things going on. One is they feel that their ability to raise cash right now is on really favorable terms. So it's great to get that cash into the company for an unknown purpose. The other is maybe they're gearing up for some serious spend and they're going to branch out into something that requires a lot of new cash, the same way that Stitch Fix used a lot of the cash from their IPO to actually start retail brands that are our first party brands. So, you know, I'm not sure that this international expansion is interesting because it's growing really fast from a user perspective, because they actually started caring about that in 2016, whereas they were very domestically focused until then. But they're really not monetizing at any significance internationally. So it could be to spend aggressively on bringing advertisers into their international funnel. But it's honestly a little puzzling.
I agree as well. This all would have had to be in the works long before the Lyft IPO, but you know, the only other reason I can think of is just to be conservative as well and make sure things go well, because DPOs are still relatively unproven. But again, if you don't need the cash, like it, which to be clear, Lyft and Uber need the cash, and we'll talk about that on the Uber episode. But if you don't need the cash and companies have raised so much in the private markets, DPO really seems like the way to go. There's no lockup period. You're not diluting yourself. You're not selling more of the company. It has a lot of advantages. You can tell I'm of the Barry McCarthy school of thought here.
Yeah. Well, you know, we've seen one DPO, and here we are now asking, like, we're looking at every deal going, why not DPO? Why not DPO? I mean, look, they did the standard thing and they did it pretty well. And I think it's not like just because Spotify did it, that's a thing that everyone feels like is a one of two options they can pursue now.
Yeah. Yet. We'll see on Slack. Okay. Should we move to our newly retitled next section?
Yes. So yes. David, tell us about this retitling.
Yeah. So, okay. This is ordinarily where we would do tech themes. But Ben and I were texting the other day and we love tech themes. It's one of our favorite parts of the show. But we realized that it's actually something more than that, and Tech Themes kind of sells it short. So we're going to rename this section to Playbook. And what's actually really interesting here is not just what themes in tech this particular company's story reflects, but what are the actionable things that we can learn from this story that we can all put in our playbooks, you know, as operators, as investors. And we think this will be really cool and a good way, in the spirit of Pinterest, to catalog all the things we're learning from this show over time. So this is going to be our first experiment with playbook.
Yep. All right. So we focused on this one, but I just want to highlight it. What makes Pinterest different is a significant focus on building out infrastructure in the company ahead of growth, in wild contrast to other unicorn cousins.
Yep. I worry a little bit that people will take the wrong lesson from the surface level facts here. And this is one of the reasons we do this show. You look at the way Pinterest has carried itself over the last 10 years, and then you look at the way, say, Uber or Lyft have carried themselves, or Airbnb too. And like, there is definite craziness going on within those other companies, and their markets are so much bigger, and they will probably end up being bigger companies in the long run. Pinterest, the market is smaller. It's extremely well managed and will be a smaller company in the long run, but I feel like much better managed. The lesson is not don't manage your company well. The lesson is target big markets, one, and two, manage your company well such that you have the highest probability of succeeding within them.
Yep. It's a great elaboration there. Another point that I wanted to, I think this is really more a point of discussion. And David, we talked on the LP show about the downsides of being a tools business rather than a platform or a network or a marketplace. Pinterest is kind of a tools business in that it's much more about me and maybe a handful of other people I'm sharing a board with. And it's much less about communicating with other people, seeing what other people are up to. So it has, I think, less significant network effects. How do you juxtapose it sort of being a tools business, but competing for the very same advertisers that these like strong network effect businesses are competing for?
Yes. Great. Okay. This is one of my entries in the playbook here. You could debate on the network effects aspect, and certainly social network effects in the way that Facebook, Instagram, you know, et cetera, have them. Pinterest does not, but I think they do have a very strong flywheel. We should do a whole LP episode where we've talked about this, where we just nerd out on like what we think the differences are between network effects and flywheels and whatnot. But the flywheel is users add content and pins to the site. The more pins there are in the site, the more things there are that users, new users and existing users, can get inspired by and then repin. And so there's a super strong flywheel where as people come on and they add content, that content drives more engagement from more users who add more content, which drives more users within the segment of people who find this whole thing attractive.
Even if it's not a super strong network effect, you can still have a super strong flywheel.
Yeah, like I don't care. I mean, well, maybe we should have an acquired pin board. So in that case, I would care that you, Ben, are on the service. But if we don't have a reason to collaborate, I don't care that like you or like any of my other friends are specifically on the service. But I care that a lot of other people are, because then they're adding content. They care about the content.
Right. And like, I don't mean to say there's not network effects. I mean, you could imagine a way worse version of Pinterest, which is you can't discover anything that anybody else uploaded. Like there's not a business there. So it's a tool, but the back end of that personal tool is powered by the incredible amount of data and work that everyone else on the platform has done.
What I think a lesson there is like an interesting one of, to maybe modify the from our LP show, you know, the lesson wasn't quite don't build tools, but it was like tools are limited. But if you can figure out how to make a tool that gets better for users as more people are on the service, sort of like Jake was talking about on with his coaching networks thesis at Emergence, that can create a powerful flywheel.
Yep.
Do you have more?
Nope, that's it.
Cool. I had a couple real quick. One, I was just struck in the history and facts, like, and we talked about it, 2008 and the recession and the Lehman Brothers collapse, like these massive events that happen in the economy and socially can have like such opportunity, you know, even and like recessions, like Airbnb. And again, we've talked about this before and we'll cover it in depth on when we do an episode on them someday. Like what enabled Airbnb was the recession and specifically the housing crisis. And same in a much less direct way, you know, led to the history that led to Pinterest and led to the history that led to Lyft. Whenever these big events happen, it's always a good idea to just pick your head up and say, okay, what is this going to, what retilling of the soil is this going to enable now, both as an investor and thinking about starting companies? The other thing I wanted to, that I think this story illustrates is just the power sometimes of just not stopping, you know, like Ben's story and Tote and Cold Brew Labs and Pinterest and like doing the business plan competition, you know, it would have been so easy to just give it up, you know, and not stopping doesn't mean banging your head against a wall with something that isn't working. It means not giving up on the idea of like building something, period. Like pivot what you're doing into something that's going to work and listen to users and find product market fit. But just calling game over means literally game over.
Yeah, it's funny. It reminds me of a great quote. So Bo Liu, the CEO of Future Advisor, spoke at one of the first startup weekends that I organized like a decade ago or something. And I remember him saying, the way to succeed is to just never admit failure. Like, as long as you don't shut down, you haven't lost. And that's not fully true. Like that's a good way to, you can have a, you know, small business that doesn't grow at all and just keep going. But like, I think what you're saying is if what you're looking to do is build something big and impactful, as long as you don't give up and build in the direction of what could catch, it's unlikely that you will do that for your entire life and have something that never works. So just keep trying. And of course,
well, it's like there's two versions of giving up and or failing. One version of it is what we are doing is not working. We have failed at that. We are going to give up doing that. That's great. Like when that's clearly the case, like you should do that and do that as soon as possible. But don't do the other version of giving up, which is saying, and thus we are going to call game over and shut down the company and like go get jobs somewhere, you know, as long as you still have the desire and the resources to keep going, like,
yep,
keep going.
Yep. You know? And there's tremendous value in keeping a team together. You know, this is something I think that we realize at Pioneer Square Labs, the 25 of us that all sort of like systematically build companies over and over and over again, is after you fail on a few things together, or maybe even succeed on a few things together, you know, in your small group, who's good at what. You have norms and communication patterns and operations around how you work together. And you get way more efficient at building together. So if something didn't work, like keeping the team together and keeping your processes intact and keeping your knowledge of what each other's competencies are is hugely valuable. And so I think for anyone considering a pivot, I mean, it's almost like, yeah, you bring some baggage when you pivot, but you bring far more value from being a team that knows how to work together.
Yeah, it's almost like the playbook is, if you think you need to pivot, you probably should have pivoted, you know, a month ago. But if you're thinking about shutting down your company and you still have a team you like and you know, money in the bank or whatever resources you need to keep going, you should definitely not shut down your company.
Yep. All right, grading. So the way that we grade these IPOs is, rather than issuing A grade, we discuss what a few years from now an A+ would look like versus, you know, say a C, D, or an F. David, I'll go first. I think an A+ looks like cracking international monetization. I think this company can continue to grow to become a $20, $30 billion market cap company over time if they can figure out how to continue growth internationally and how to monetize internationally like they do domestically. I don't think it's a crazy playbook to do that, but I don't think there's a bigger success path than that.
Yeah. It's funny. I was going to say like the A+ to me is,
yeah, I suppose that's,
they
an
take
A.
This, they, yeah, I think that's an A. That's like an A- to A. The A+ is they take all this money they just raised in the IPO and they have some vision that they are keeping secret for now. And Ben isn't telling anyone yet about how they're going to expand the market here. And they use these resources, whether through acquisition or investment internally to do that. That would be like, yes, that takes them to, you know, multi-100 billion market cap company. I think it's really hard. Like, I have no idea what that vision would be. So I think that's hard. But yeah, so otherwise, I think the scenario you described is like super solid A- to A.
You know, there's a possibility that they won't be able to monetize internationally like they can with the US. or even that people start churning off of them because Instagram manages to launch something that sort of leverages their really close relationship with users to get them to start using a Pinterest-like experience. And, you know, Facebook is a total shark at figuring out whether they have something there or not, and rolling it out broadly. So my F there would be if, one, they can't monetize internationally, or two, they get their legs cut out by Facebook.
You know, one thing that we didn't, usually we find these things when we do our research, but for whatever reason we didn't this time, is, do you think Facebook ever tried to buy Pinterest, or anybody else tried to buy Pinterest?
So Facebook did not, not that I found, try to buy Pinterest. There actually was a story very early on in New York.
Where
Ben tried to encourage a magazine publisher to buy them, but the publisher
this
declined
is back when they were
the
Tote, I think, right?
Yeah, it was like 2010 or something.
So that doesn't count. But I don't know if that's because nobody ever did try to buy Pinterest, or their valuation grew so quickly,
just
like the company is so quiet and introverted that the stories never got told. But this is a rarity in that there aren't stories like this out there.
It's kind of interesting to think about. Could anyone buy them? Maybe Facebook.
Yeah, I mean, their valuation is, you know, they're a $16 billion market cap company. Of course, somebody could buy them. Facebook could buy them. Amazon could buy them.
I guess where would it make sense? Yeah.
And also, like, culturally, you know, I think Pinterest would be very attractive to Facebook right now for lots of reasons. But could it work culturally within the company? I think that'd be hard.
Yeah. Well, I think Facebook needs to do something to change both public perception and retain employees. So it wouldn't strike me to see Facebook do something dramatic soon.
And so the C-D case, I think, is that they have fully saturated monetization in the U.S. They can't monetize internationally. And this is a break-even $700 million to $1 billion revenue business going forward.
Yeah. And frankly, like, they just raised a bunch of cash. Like, the way that we grade these acquisitions is, when you acquire this asset, are you able to do something interesting with it? You know, with this IPO, it's like they just raised all this money. What are they going to do with it? So I think, you know, I'd like to see them take a shot on goal with that.
Seed IPOs. Got to spend the money. All right. Should we move on to carve-outs?
Yeah, let's do it. Mine is, I've done this podcast before, but there was just an exceptional episode. Invest Like the Best. It's a great podcast.
So good.
Really good interview show. Recently, I had an episode with Eugene Wei, and Eugene wrote this great blog post, Invisible Asymptotes, which shouldn't even call it it's an essay. It's a half novel. And Eugene is super brilliant, and there's 5 or 6 very interesting takeaways from this Invest Like the Best episode. My favorite of them is applying blockchain theory to social networks. So if you think about what makes a blockchain work, there is proof of work, and then there is a reward for doing that work. And the reward is sort of synonymously the proof of work, and has an intrinsic value thing, and that propagates out over a network. And I had never thought before to use that paradigm to apply it to a social network. And so when you do something like post on Instagram, you're doing a proof of work, and you're putting up that picture. That picture has, you know, value, and you get likes and follows in exchange for doing that work. And the people who are the most successful on that platform are the people who are able to work within the constraints of that social media to basically do the most interesting thing within those constraints. And a successful social network happens when you are able to create a format that, where that proof of work is extremely variable. So the breadth of skill is, you can do really crappy things with it, and you can also do amazing, wonderful things with it. And also that the perception of the value of the proof of work is variable. And so it's not everybody agrees that that is the best picture. And everybody can sort of have a different interpretation of what high quality is. And a new social network can emerge when there is a tool set to do that proof of work, to make that profile, to do that image, whatever it is, that enables, and of course I am Eugene says it much more eloquently. But
I'm only even trying to follow along because of my respect for you and Eugene. Otherwise, you would have lost me at blockchain.
Sorry. Well, no, anyway, it's okay. suffice to say, it's interesting fodder if you're thinking about how do new social paradigms emerge and what creates explosive growth social network and what doesn't. And I think the comparison to blockchain is a
metaphor.
It's an interesting framework. Yeah.
Yeah. So great. So great. Patrick does an awesome job with the Invest Like the Best podcast. And I love it. If you're an acquired listener who doesn't listen to that yet, you definitely are going to love it too. So add it to your playlist. Okay. Mine is, well, first I want to underscore, Ben, your carve out on the Lyft IPO episode, Bill Gurley's talk about running down a dream and finding and succeeding in a career you love. I did run, not walk, to go watch it, and it is so good. I sent it to so many friends, like, so great. I just have so much respect for Bill and every dimension, but so cool of him to like do this talk, go do it at his alma mater at UT. It's really inspiring, no matter where you are in your career. So I would definitely want to underscore, if you haven't watched that yet, go watch it. But my carve out for the week is similar. Somebody who has found a career that he loves and is succeeding at it is Alex Rodriguez. A-Rod. A-Rod's interviews on ESPN and on YouTube are so good. Like, I just love watching them. Whatever you think about A-Rod, the baseball player, like A-Rod, the post-career, you know, video and television journalist and interviewer, is amazing. Like, he's so smart. He's so dedicated to, was so dedicated to his craft of playing baseball and hitting, and now to being an interviewer, and just like watching him nerd out with other people who are also dedicated to their craft is great. So every interview is great. One of my favorites is his interview with Astros center fielder George Springer. So we'll link to that. He also has a great one with Giancarlo Stanton at the Yankees. And but you can't go wrong. Watch, search A-Rod on YouTube. You'll enjoy yourself.
Thanks, David. This is a great time to tell you about one of our very favorite companies, Crusoe.
So Crusoe, as listeners know by now, is a clean compute cloud provider specifically built for AI workloads. NVIDIA is one of their major partners, and literally Crusoe's data centers are nothing but racks and racks of A100s and H100s. And because Crusoe's cloud is purpose-built for AI and run on wasted, stranded, or clean energy, they can provide significantly better performance per dollar than traditional cloud providers.
Yes, we talked about that on our ACQ2 episode with Crusoe CEO Chase Lockmiller.
The other element that makes Crusoe special is the environmental angle. Crusoe, of course, locates their data centers at stranded energy sites. So think oil flares, wind farms that can't use all the energy they generate, etc., and uses that power that would otherwise be wasted to run your AI workloads instead.
Yep. Obviously, it's a huge benefit for the environment and for customers on costs, since Crusoe doesn't rely on the energy grid. Energy is the second largest cost of running AI after, of course, the price you pay NVIDIA for the chips. And these lower energy costs get passed on to customers.
It's super cool that they can put their data centers out there in these remote locations where, quote unquote, energy happens, as opposed to the other hyperscalers such as AWS and Google and Azure, who need to build their data centers close to major traffic hubs where the internet happens, because they are doing everything in their clouds.
Yep. If you, your company, or your portfolio companies would like to use the lower cost and more performant infrastructure for your AI workloads, go to crusoecloud.com/acquired. That's crusoecloud.com/acquired, or click the link in the show notes. Well, listeners, if you aren't subscribed and you like what you hear, you should subscribe. We'll be gloriously covering all of the big upcoming IPOs. And if you want to go deeper on what it's like to build a startup, get interviews with expert operators and VCs, and explore some of my personal beliefs, and I know David's as well, you should become a limited partner. You can go to glow.fm/acquired. Seriously, I promise you'll be overjoyed with how buttery smooth it is to get more acquired right here in your favorite podcast player. And as of today, everyone starts with a free 7-day trial. And with that, we will see you next time.
Yeah.